Hello, this is Ray Hill. You're listening to Texas Execution Watch. It is Tuesday, the 21st day of October. We have an execution scheduled tonight. We're going to begin with Steve Earle with a musical interlude. We'll be right back with tonight's show.
I was fresh out of the service, it was back in 82. I raised some cane when I come back to town. I left to be all I could be, come home without a clue. I married Dawn and had to settle down. So I hired on at the prison. Guess I always knew I would. Just like my dad and both my uncles done. And I've worked on every cell block now, and things are going good. But then they transferred me to LS Unit 1.
And the song is Steve Earle singing Ellis Unit 1, Swing Low, Swing Low. It was originally recorded for Helen Prejean's documentary Dead Man Walking. And as we go through other songs looking for a permanent theme song for this program, we will use that. Gloria, she's potted up. Gloria, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How
are
you doing?
I am well. Let's give you a little more gain here. Where are you?
I'm in Huntsville outside of the Walsh Unit, and I just watched the Witnesses to Justice Rise execution. All right. We're getting responses to our sign that says honk to stop executions.
Good.
The Witnesses have entered the Walsh Unit, and the execution, the murder of Joseph Rise, is about to begin. We have a large group out here, including 17 students from a sociology class, who are studying social movements in the U.S., and they got extra credit for coming to watch a social movement.
Well, I wonder who their professor might be.
Well, you know, it's not Dennis. It's a friend of his. Dennis is actually speaking to their class tomorrow.
Okay. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the execution tonight. Elizabeth got word earlier. From the state attorney's office that the Supreme Court this afternoon, of the United States denied. So what you're witnessing is the beginning of the process that apparently is going to play through. You have Elizabeth's cell phone. Get back in touch with us when there is changes.
Okay, and I think it's important for listeners to know that this is the third of 12 executions that are preceding the Thanksgiving holidays, and so after tonight there'll be 9 more, which is something that people in most states of the United States of America can't even fathom. But in 6 weeks, they will, if they all go through, there will be 12 people executed.
Well, there's been a total of this is the 12th person executed in Texas since the first of the year. And just before the holidays, we have this rapid increase in numbers.
Yes.
So that we're going to, by Thanksgiving, I'm trying to do a little math here, we'll have a total of 23 people executed.
Right.
From the beginning of the year. And 23 people executed in a single state in a single year is just unheard of.
Actually, executions didn't start till June this year because of a pending Supreme Court ruling on the constitutionality of lethal injections. So really, from June till Thanksgiving, we'll have 23.
That's a,
you're talking about a six-month period.
That's amazing. While I've got you on the phone, Gloria, on the issue of execution, do you have an event going on this Saturday?
Are you there?
Yeah, you can hear me. You have an event this Saturday?
Yeah, absolutely. People will be coming from around the state. And actually, I just got a phone call from somebody in Europe who's flying in Friday. But it's the 9th annual Texas March to End Executions, and it's going to start at 2 o'clock at the Shape Center on Alameda in Alabama. And we're going to march to the Shape Center on Live Oak in Alabama. We're going to be led by a wonderful new organization composed of predominantly family members of a man on death row named Jeff Wood, who was an innocent man sentenced under the law of parties. So this group is called Kids Against the Death Penalty, and they have their own web page, their own signs, their own banners, their own flyers, and they're very excited because we invited them to lead the march this year. And then to contrast with the kids, our next group of people is going to be the elders from Shade Community Center and other elders who are going to join them, the elders against the death penalty. So our march is going to be a very broad group of people.
Begins at what time again?
Pardon me?
Begins at what time again?
At 2 o'clock Saturday. And our guest speaker is Clarence Branly, who was exonerated off of death row after almost 10 years. And another important speaker is Connie Wright, whose husband is set to be executed a few days after the march and is still working on getting DNA testing in his case. And so she will also be joining us.
Okay, Gloria, call Elizabeth back so that we can put you back on, and we may have some questions about the telephone situation when that happens.
Oh, okay. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's Gloria Ruback. She's been an activist in the execution movement for some years. She's a regular on the prison show, used to have her own show on KPFT. She is in Huntsville outside the Walls unit as they are preparing to execute Robert Ratliff. Joseph Rise. Robert Ratliff, 64 years old, was the victim of this back in 1999. There is a co-defendant, Christopher White. Both Rise and White were 19 at the time of the crime. And you've had a chance to look at this, have you?
Yes.
Okay, what do you find, Jim? Now, Jim Skelton, who is a local attorney who actually keeps other attorneys up to speed with the case of the law, and he is the other member of our team here. What does this look like?
Okay, here's what happened in this particular case, at least what the evidence at trial showed. Rise had been in one of those tragic things. He was raised in a very abusive home. He'd been sexually abused. In fact, CPS said, came in on two different occasions and took him away from his mother and father. Apparently, his mother had a bad drug habit. And he spent time in like 11 different foster homes during that period of time and started using marijuana. Well, it didn't start. He had his first marijuana cigarette when he was like 12 years old.
Stole it from his mother.
Stole it from his mom, that's right. But unlike most kids who come from a real tragic background, he managed to finish high school, and that's usually unusual. And another thing that's kind of unusual in this case, he was brighter than, for example, a lot of kids on death row who are abused or not very bright. Rise, on the other hand, was fairly intelligent. And apparently he was going to Texas A&M at Commerce and discovered more drugs there and claimed he'd been a lot of smoking marijuana laced with PCP. And what happened, at least you can kind of gut guess, this didn't come out in trial. Usually kids like that, when they're bounced from home to home and they have that like 11 different foster homes, that tell you they've been a real problem discipline-wise. And it's really difficult for folks to understand when a kid's gone through this type of background, he's not going to change overnight. Even loving and giving him reinforcement's not going to do a whole lot of good for a while, because I know I worked on a juvenile prosecutor, and I was in charge of a juvenile probation department. I had to place kids in foster homes back years ago. And I kept telling these people, I said, you're not dealing with an average kid. It's like, it's the same thing. Think of it like that. If you had a dog that had a real bad problem and is beat up a lot, before you tame it, he's going to bite you a few times. I mean, that's just inevitable. So I'm assuming what happened, that during the times he got in foster homes, he probably was not getting along well, and that's to be expected. And apparently, kind of reading between the lines, an older man, he was 64 years old, a guy named Robert Lee Ratliff, and this kiddo was 19 years old, apparently took him in to his home, and he lived up north and west of Dallas, up around Commerce. Mm-hmm. And the trial transcript never said exactly what occurred, at least the opinions didn't, but somehow Ratliff got mad at this kid and threw him out of the house. Apparently things had been missing, being stolen. And so that's to kind of be expected. As I've told, like I say, I've told folks before, when they take on these kids, you're not dealing with somebody who's completely normal. You've got to expect a certain amount of bad behavior. Well, anyway, Ratliff threw him out of his house. And then after that, Ratliff and this other kid by the name of Christopher White went to Ratliff's home and stole his pickup. And they were living, like I say, north of Dallas, and they drove down to San Antonio, and this is what the trial transcript said, but it sounds a little bit crazy. They claimed the pickup didn't give good gas mileage, and so they wanted to swap it for a Lincoln, which gets better. It gets pretty good gas mileage, surprising. But that sounds like kind of like one of those things that I don't have a lot of faith in. But anyway, what happened? They go back to Ratliff's home. He's not there when they arrive, and so they drove the pickup off in some type of pond and drowned it, and decided to steal the Lincoln. So they go back to the house, and the Lincoln's not there because Ratliff's not home. So they break into the house, steal some guns, steal some money, steal some stuff, and wait for Ratliff to come home. And Ratliff came home later on that evening, and about 30 minutes after the lights go out, these kids break into the house again. And Rise goes, and apparently in Ratliff's bedroom, to get the car keys and the billfold. And they say that at this point, that Rise shoots Mr. Ratliff in the back, or shoots him while he's sleeping, which wakes him up, obviously. And then he shoots him again. And then, according to what the trial said, they shot him a third time behind the ear, and he said that was really to get him out of his suffering because he'd shot him twice. And then what happened after they shoot and kill Mr. Ratliff, they get in the Lincoln and take off, and they're arrested later in Altus, Oklahoma, driving the Lincoln. In fact, Rise is wearing Ratliff's hat when they catch him. So he's caught with the stolen goods taken from the robbery murder. And then on top of that, he gives a video confession. Which, in a case like this, means the only issue you've got, that guilt or innocence, is pretty well foregone. It's just sentencing. It's all a sentencing trial. And there's where all the issues came up in this case, is during the sentencing. And a lot of times in cases like this, lawyers will plead a client guilty to try to get some sympathy from a jury. And the reason they do that is because they don't want to go in and so obviously somebody is guilty, that they're going to lose some credibility by claiming they're not guilty. But in this case, they said not guilty. I think the jury found him guilty in like 7 minutes, so you can tell how strong the evidence was. And the only issue raised up during the guilt or innocence part, when they played the video recording, one of the questions the police asked, if he was sorry that it happened, and Rise apologized about what he had done, claimed he was high on drugs, didn't know what he was doing. And he said a lot of what a lot of people have said before. You'll find this fairly often in death penalty cases. In fact, Truman Capote wrote about in his book In Cold Blood, that when a lot of guys describe the murder they did, they think of it, they kind of have a body, out-of-body experience. It's like they're watching the murder themselves, like somebody else is doing it and they're seeing it. And that's pretty well the way he described it. He didn't remember a lot about it because he was high on drugs during that period of time. And you find that fairly typically true of a lot of people when they describe the murder. A lot of times they'll even laugh when they're doing it. And it's probably not because they're happy. It's kind of a nervous reaction. And that's a fairly common thing among people who commit murders. Anyway, he gives a video confession. He makes an apology. In fact, on videotape, he apologizes to the family and says he's sorry for what he's done and all that. But when they played the video at Guilt or Innocence, they took the apology out. They never, lawyers can never use a normal word. They redact it, which means they just simply eliminated it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he also admitted committing a series of other crimes because when he's growing up, he gets involved in the typical stuff like kids like this do. Some of the things he did, he sexually molested a half-sister. He did some stealing, did some thieving, did some burglaries and things of that nature. Well, they excluded all of that at guilt or innocence. And then what happened, he comes down for trial. His lawyer introduced a good deal of evidence and what we call in mitigation. We've nicknamed that a Penry instruction. In fact, they got in virtually all the CPS records that showed all of the traumatic background he had gone through. The unfortunate thing about that is that, as a general rule, when you have those traumatic things happen, you also have a lot of bad things they did also because of reaction to how they're treated. They introduced all of his CPS records, even got his mother to take the stand and to admit that what she had done, what she had negligent, she had been in raising the child because she herself had been a drug addict. And she even took the stand and admitted this. They called a Marine Corps recruiter who apparently knew his background. They called a number of people who testified about his traumatic childhood. And here's where the really kind of the bad part came in. During the punishment hearing, now the reason they excluded the apology during guilt or innocence, and most judges would have, because the only issue guilt or innocence is whether or not you did it.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that you're sorry really is not a defense one way or the other. But that is relevant to a punishment hearing. Because a punishment hearing, are you going to be a future danger in a punishment hearing? It should have come in then.
This is 19 years old. Future dangerousness should be a legitimate issue here.
And especially the fact that he was remorseful when he was caught. And what happened, they replayed the confession again at punishment, and again did not play the part about him apologizing for the killing. His lawyer made no objection to that at trial. And everybody that would know anything about criminal law would tell you that part of the tape would be admissible. But there was no objection made at trial that part of the tape was omitted. And here's what's horrible about it. The state used the tape as an example of why he was not remorseful. They just turned it back on him when in fact he had apologized, but that was never played to the jury.
And this is the issue that you get into of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yeah.
If you do not object to an error when it happened, you can't bring it up later?
Here's what you do. How you do that, you can usually bring it up through a writ on a lawyer being ineffective. But let me tell you the problem with the ineffective, the problem that comes with ineffective assistance of counsel. The standard is what we call the Strickland standard. It's a case called Strickland versus Washington that discusses lawyers being ineffective. And here's what you've got to prove. To get a case reversed, you've got to prove, number one, that your lawyer fell below the standard of negligence. It's a negligence standard. He didn't do what other lawyers with his experience should have done. That usually is easy to prove because very few trials were error-proof. And in this case, not admitting the rest of that tape, showing the remorseful thing, obviously falls below the standard. The real problem is there's a two-phase test. You've got to fall below the standard of other lawyers, but you've got to have what we call the but-for test. And that but-for test is that the result would have been different but for the conduct. And what they do, you've got to be able to demonstrate that but for the negligence on the part of the lawyer, the result would have been different. Now, you have a call coming in or something?
Well, they're working on
okay.
The call.
Anyway, the problem is you can always show the negligence as a general rule, but what happens, and those what the courts really act as a 13th juror, saying that but for the error, the result would have been different. Well, the question is, would they have not given him the death penalty had they heard about the apology? That's really the question.
And after guilt or innocence, the issue is life or death.
That's right. And so what the court said is that, granted, the lawyer should have objected, and it was ineffective for not doing so, but they're saying after look at the whole record, because of the confession, because of his criminal background, because he admitted being on drugs, even had that testimony came in about the apology, the result would have still been the same. Therefore, that's why they say the lawyer, that's the standard, you've got to prove that the result would have been different. They said in this case, the result would not be different. I think your phone call's ready.
Yeah, now, and hold that thought, because
sure.
I want to come back to that.
Sure.
Dave, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Ray, but speak up. I can hear you.
Okay, you're on the air.
Okay.
We've had contact with the vigil in Austin, which is pretty well attended. What can you tell us about what's going on in Houston?
Well, we're at the corner of Main and Bissonnette, right by the museum. We don't have a large group here, unfortunately. We've got a relatively small group, but some of the faithful protesters are here. And we've got there's a lot of traffic that goes by this location from both directions. And what's interesting, Ray, is that we really get a lot of positive affirmation for what we're doing. And we've had a lot of discussions about, you know, the value of these protests right down here in the heart of Houston. And most of us feel, even if it's not as, you know, a really big group, that it's worthwhile doing. And so we are here, and a lot of cars going by, giving us thumbs up, tooting their horns. Every now and then you'll get a negative, but it's certainly different than it was 10 years ago, I can tell you that.
Well, word we have from Huntsville is that the witnesses have crossed and gone in. The process is in place, and Jim and I are sitting here discussing the case and the evolution of the case, and we haven't gotten into the appeals yet, but we're going to. And so I suppose we'll let you go for the evening. Do you have any other events? Last time we were on together, you had a teach-in coming up. Is anything going on with you and your group?
No, we don't have a teach-in coming up or anything like that right away. We will have something on the we always try to have something on around December 7th, when they started up executions in Texas back in 1982. We'll be doing something in Austin. Last time we had a press conference, and we put out an annual report on what's happened during the year, Texas relative to the rest of the country, and we'll be doing that again. I'm not sure we're going to have a press conference this time, but that's probably the next thing that we'll have this year that I'm aware of. Well, wait a second. I should say something else. At the end of this month, in Austin again, there's going to be a group of exonerated prisoners. Their name is Witness to Innocence, who will be coming into Austin for their annual meeting. And we'll be hooking up with them, and I think they're going to have maybe 20 exonerated prisoners. I think Clarence Branley from Houston will be going, but the most of the people that will be there from around the country. And they have their own organization now, and so we'll be seeing them up in Austin, and that's on the 29th and 30th of this month. So that'll be good. Of course, it's going to be hard to catch anybody's attention.
Where can people go for more information on that, Dave?
Go to the Texas Coalition website, tcadp.org, or Google Witness to Innocence.
Okay.
One of those two ought to get you the information.
Thank you, Dave.
All right. Good to talk with you. Bye-bye. Right.
And that was Dave Atwood, who is past president of Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Dave is a member of the board of the National Coalition, and their work has been ongoing for many years. Like Gloria, who was on earlier, these are activists in the field. Dave is also past president of Houston Peace and Justice Center. And their website is www.tcadp.org. And so now I'm going to go back with Jim. Jim,
yeah.
Before we let off, we were talking about the appellate value of these issues, where the court said that they had to conceivably had to anticipate making a difference.
It's not what they did. It's even
like
more
powerful.
It's really strict.
Value judgment.
There's got to be a reasonable probability, in the way they word it, there must be a reasonable probability the result would have been different but for the error of the lawyer. And we call that the but-for rule. And but for the error of the lawyer, the result would have been different. And what they generally do, you see this over and over again when you read these cases, they're saying the evidence of guilt is overwhelming. Look at all the evidence and saying even had the testimony came in about the apology, it's not likely the jury verdict would have been different. It's a gut guess on the judge's parts. And here's what makes it difficult if my death penalty cases are so hard, is because everything is based upon that initial appeal. As a general rule, and we've told lawyers this over and over again, in most of your death penalty cases, there is usually no great issues of guilt or innocence.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually it's a case like this. I mean, how do you defend it? Because you find a youngster that's driving the car of the man he killed. He's wearing his clothing, and he confesses to it. Now, you know, you can get all the words in the English language, you're not going to get a not guilty. So the issue is punishment. And truthfully, the whole issue boils down to, does the jury think he's going to be a danger in the future? Well, see, here's one of the... See, that bringing in the mitigating evidence is a two-edged sword, because when you show you got a defective person, so to speak, someone who's been abused, it kind of scares people because they're not going to get, you know, straightened up in a short period of time. And there's that inclination to kill. It's like the same sort of analogy that lawyers have used. It's like you have a real good dog, but he kills sheep. He's a sheep dog. And although you love him, you can't afford to let the sheep be in danger by some dog who kills sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens when you bring in a lot of this evidence about their tragic background, it's always going to have with it some evidence that they go through the tragic background. There's going to be criminal behavior, too. And it cuts two ways. It can also be an incentive to give somebody the death penalty because they ain't likely to fix that person, so to speak. He's still going to be a danger because he's still carrying that anger and animosity. And so that's a real difficult line to walk if you're a lawyer. And so what happens, really the only issue in 99% of all death penalty cases is the punishment issue. Then what happens once that case is appealed, you have to put everything, any possible error in the appeal, in your direct appeal, and then later on, if the direct appeal is affirmed, you can bring back and introduce new evidence at a post-conviction writ. And here's why that's critically important, that direct appeal, what evidence you bring up then, and evidence you bring up in your post-conviction writ, that is the only thing federal courts will consider. They don't retry the case when it's appealed to federal court. All they do is look at the opinions issued on direct appeal and the opinions issued on the writ, and if it's not brought up there, you're out of court. If something new comes up, you're out of court.
Now, originally, the district attorney of that jurisdiction made the decision to make this a capital case.
Exactly. He's the one that makes the decision.
That's his or her sole job. I mean, nobody else mitigates that.
Nobody. In fact, I doubt seriously if this crime occurred today if they'd seek the death penalty. I mean, this is not... When you start comparing murders to murders, it's a horrible thing to have to talk about.
But would it have been different then if it had been, say, Houston?
Absolutely. Dallas? They would not assault the death penalty, in my opinion, on a case like this. Because we've been doing this show for some time now. We have these horrible things of people throwing folks on the floor and shooting them in the head and raping their widows. Really egregious facts. There's nothing about this case when you compare it to just a regular murder that's much different. The only reason it qualified as a capital murder, it was a murder committed during the course of a burglary. But there was nothing particularly egregious about it so far as you compare it to other murder cases. And had this been tried in Houston, or done in Houston, they'd never sought the death penalty. Even in the worst days here, they wouldn't have done it.
They might not have offered a plea of less than a serious life, but...
That's very true. But back then, of course, you could have life without parole. You could at least parole that out. But this is unusual. This is why a lot of people are against the death penalty, because of this disparity in how DAs seek the death sentence. Like, in most metropolitan areas, they would never assault the death sentence in a case like this, because, first off, the kid's got some appealing things. He's got some much redeemability, because his tragic background should mitigate some. Plus, he's about half bright.
Well, the defense attorney is probably being paid by the county.
In this case, I'd almost guarantee it's an appointed lawyer.
And he might have had limited resources to bring in the kind of expert witnesses necessary to prove that this young man did have some future potential at being redeemed, right?
Absolutely, because back then they weren't nearly as generous on what kind of money they gave for experts. And according to the only transcripts that are available, the only thing that's available currently that I could pick up, were the opinions out of the federal courts. So all the opinions in state courts were unpublished opinions, and therefore you can't find them. And there was nothing to indicate at the punishment hearing that an expert was called on either side. There was no expert testimony. It was all consist of CPS records. They had a CPS worker who interpreted part of the records. They had family members to testify. And on the state side, they had policemen to testify. He had a bad reputation. And then they had that Marine Corps recruiter who apparently had talked to this kid and apparently did not go in the Marine Corps. So obviously, he probably had some bad things to say about this kid.
Just a minute.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
We've got Gloria back on. Gloria, what has happened?
Well, the execution is over. The witnesses have come out, and Joseph Rise is dead. And that's, what, 3 out of the 12 executions that were scheduled for 6 weeks
and
have taken place. We have 9 more to go. And it's interesting. I was just talking to Professor Dennis Longmire, who is going to witness an execution next week. And it so happens that the issues in that case and in this case were similar in that these two men had didn't remember what they had done, and were in the case that Dennis is going to had lesions on his brain that could be seen from an X-ray, and Dick Burr is trying to get back in court with it to show that chemicals from his stint in the military affected his brain. But apparently that's what happened in the case tonight also. So,
well, as Jim and I were talking about it, it said that you know, if this case had occurred in a urban area, say Houston, even as execution prone as Houston was, it likely would not have been filed as a capital case, because there's nothing really egregious compared to other murders in this case. And that the circumstances that it may be something about Commerce, Texas, the county seat, that caused this case to be filed as a capital case.
Well, that's interesting. But then the case that Dennis is witnessing next week is a Harris County case. Richard Burr is a lawyer who's one of the best. And I don't know. Apparently in his original trial, this type of information was introduced. But now they've even got newer science, I guess, to talk about this issue.
Well, could you help us help?
Pardon me?
Could you help Elizabeth maybe get connected with Mr. Burns for that broadcast?
Sure.
Because I think we need to delve into these issues as deeply as we can. If we can get involved with the lawyers involved in the cases,
right,
that would help sort some of that stuff out.
Because if there's science to show why people kill or why they whatever, the science needs to be made known. And Dennis is saying, you know, that's what they're trying to get done before this guy's date next Tuesday.
Now, you are one of the few people that are traveling from Houston to Huntsville, because there's going to be no visits at all on any units in Texas prisons.
On any unit.
This weekend and until further notice.
Yeah.
And all of that dealt with a cell phone on death row. Do you have any comments?
Yeah, I do have a comment. If the Texas Department of Criminal Justice allowed telephone calls And they have approved it for general population, but not for ADSEG and death row. They wouldn't have this problem. They also wouldn't have this problem if they paid their guards decent money. Maybe they get people with a little more intelligence on top of it. So I hold them responsible for isolating 370 people on death row, dividing families, separating families. Many people cannot afford the trip to visit to Livingston. And as far as I'm concerned, Rick Perry and the Board of Criminal Justice are responsible for this. They should not separate families. People are supposed to be locked up by law, but they're not supposed to be separated from their families and their loved ones. And yeah, cell phones are very prevalent all over the system. I'm very excited.
The paper case
and decided to call Whitmire, but
the paper said that there have been 700 incidences of telephones in the system-wide in the last year.
Well, I have a feeling that's a small fraction of the cell phones. But, and the other thing is, TDC would have to shut down tomorrow if they got rid of every guard that smuggled in a cell phone. And they're already short-staffed. So I think they're between a rock and a hard place. They need to allow every prisoner phone calls, and they need to get that system set up. And then they need to pay their guards so that they don't need to be smuggling in.
Well, you know, the thing most people, and I haven't seen it in the story, if you're a regular custodial officer,
uh-huh.
When you come in and go out, you have one of those clear plastic bags like they make elementary school kids
right.
carry. That's how you carry your lunch and your other paraphernalia in and out. The only people that can actually walk through the pickets with a cell phone have got to be lieutenants, captains, majors, or above.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that the guards aren't even going to be allowed to bring in food and water now.
Okay. Thank you very much for keeping us posted in Huntsville. Give our regards to the other folks at the vigil. And,
okay.
We'll talk to you later, Gloria. I'll see you Friday, I hope.
Friday, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that catches up with Gloria. The process has been completed, and Jim and I have been discussing this thing. Jim, you've been practicing law in Texas for a good many years.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something about Texas that makes executions big deal? You know, it wasn't until George Bush became governor that we had this enormous rush to execution. George Bush presided over more executions than any other governor in history.
You know, that's a real good question. I think the fault lies primarily in DA's offices. For example, Dallas County at one time was a real... When I first went and worked in the DA's office in Harris County, that was back in the end of the Vietnam deal.
Okay.
And Dallas was real nuts. They had all the real radical prosecutors.
That Carol Vance era?
That was back during... I was in Carol Vance era, but Henry Wade was a DA up in Dallas
sure.
County. And they were putting kids in jail for burning flags and mm-hmm. doing stuff like that. I'm just crazy. Basic people. And an administration like that would seek the death penalty time and time again. There's a guy named Bill Alexander who was their first assistant and would work with Henry Wade.
Yeah.
And they put a whole bunch of people in jail that they're now letting out because they were wrongly convicted. And during Carol Vance's day, Carol was a pretty moderate, sensible sort of person. Wasn't nearly as nutty until Johnny Holmes got on the scene. And Johnny, I worked with Johnny's assistant DA. And Johnny really was a wannabe cop. Here's where I think the problem comes in. You're supposed to represent the state of Texas. And when Johnny became the district attorney in Harris County, he started representing the police department. And the tail began to wag the dog. And what happened, in fact, when Johnny was going to school in Austin, he used to drive a police-type car with a police radio scanner. He'd show up at crime scenes. In fact, he should have been sheriff. He should have even not better off being sheriff than DA. And you've got that kind of basically the DA's office was influenced and run by the police department. It started that with Johnny Holmes, and with Chuck Rosenthal, who's got less brains than a cocker spaniel, carried that tradition on. And they were more active in seeking the death penalty. They became what Dallas used to be, a bunch of kind of mad dog rabid people. And I think that if ever DA tried as many capital cases as they did in Harris County, you'd see this nationwide. Because if you read newspapers and read comments, like in this particular case, I read comments in different newspaper articles, and everybody wants to kill somebody, it seems like. Nobody's very moderate anymore. And I think the fault lies with district attorneys who seek the death penalty. For example, when you look at the breakdown of the people on death row from Harris County compared to other counties, it's dramatically different on the number from Harris County as opposed to Dallas County, Tarrant County, mm-hmm. and Bexar County. Mm-hmm. And the reason is not because people are different here, it's the people is because we've had prosecutors.
So the real decision is solely in the hands of the district attorney.
Absolutely.
And so if people are concerned about hyperactive executions or not, then the selection of district attorney, which is a political process, these people are run for public office.
Sure.
And various parties, and get elected or they don't get elected. Where does economics enter the picture?
Big part. It's become a big part now. Recently, some time ago, people had not been too worried about economic things. But because it's become so expensive to seek the death penalty because of all the appeals you have to pay for, a lot of these smaller counties have backed off from it. I'll give you an example of how foolish this can be if you got the wrong DA. There was a case in Oklahoma where they got the death penalty, tried him a second time for the death penalty. They got two death penalties. Mm-hmm. And they asked the prosecutor, why are you wasting that money? He said, well, I want them good and damn dead. So, I mean, it's just stupid. There was a case not long ago outside of Huntsville where they were seeking the death penalty. A guy 60-something years old.
Yeah.
Well, if he'd have gotten alive, he would have died in prison anyway. Why spend the money?
Just an ordinary run-of-the-mill life.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't have to have a capital life.
That's right. And so what happened, people now become more aware of the cost involved. And, you know, Harris County's never had a problem providing money because we've got a huge tax base here with our property taxes.
Sure.
So, I mean, God, we got tons and tons and tons and tons of money. And it's never been an issue here. Now, in smaller counties like down in the valley where their economic base is poor, like in Galveston mm-hmm. County, they're less likely to seek the death penalty because of the cost. Also, what happens in bigger cities, a DA's office can insulate itself from the general public much easier than they can in a smaller town.
Do they do that?
Yes.
Is that an intentional thing?
Well, give you an example. When I was an assistant DA under Carol Vance,
mm-hmm.
and what we used to do, all the lawyers that did a lot of trial work would go to meet at a club afterwards, after hours, and the defense lawyers hung out with the prosecutors, and it was kind of a club. And after Johnny got in there, somehow got this idea, when Johnny Holmes became prosecutor, it kind of got this idea, us against them, and they kept saying we're doing the Lord's work, and that people who defended people were not worthy to. And there's no association now. There's no. I tried to get some mutual seminars going together, having a criminal defense bar with both prosecutors and both defense lawyers. You can't get that off the ground because there's that attitude that prosecutors had. They can't associate with us. And they insulate themselves. You're going to find, and you'll notice this, that we have a lot of female prosecutors who are married to cops. And basically, we have a DA's office that's run by the police department. They don't represent the state of Texas. They represent police agencies, and we literally, when you talk about a police state, this is basically what you got, and this is why Harris County is so bad about the death penalty.
Well, is anything subject to change that?
Well, hopefully. We're going to have a new district attorney. We're going to have one beginning in January, hopefully,
sure.
at UDA. And
anything
say,
that happens, we have a change.
Well, it's somewhat discouraging because, for example, we're spending tons and tons of money on jails. And we have legislation now, for example, where a policeman, if he wants to, the police department can give a citation on a Class B misdemeanor marijuana case. They're doing this in Austin to keep people out of jail. And to my knowledge, both candidates running for DA are not going to go for that program. They're going to still start filling up jails again, which is just stupid. And I don't see much of a change. They claim when they're running for office, they claim they're going to be more liberal and more concerned about the death penalty, but I think that's only because the public is kind of getting turned off. I don't think there's any leadership in either one of the two candidates.
Well, I mean, you may
bail out on this one, but I mean, you're a lawyer. You deal with criminal defendants.
Sure.
Do defendants get worse going to jails and prisons?
Of course they get worse. I mean, I've said this time and time again, that if a hospital turned out a dangerous product as bad as prisons, that we'd shut them down. Of course they get worse. A good example was that case we had, what was it, a month and a half ago, where a guy just out on parole raped and killed a 93-year-old woman with all that rage. That rage came from the way he was treated in TDC. You know, I've never understood this, and it just doesn't make any sense to me. We've got about 4 or 5 universities here in this town. And we've got psychology departments in all these universities. Mm-hmm. And yet there's never, ever, ever been any movement on the part of the Sheriff's Department to have some of these kiddos who are graduate students coming into jail holding group therapy sessions and trying to deal with people's problems.
Or even study.
If you told that to Tommy Thomas, he'd pee down both legs. I've known Tommy Thomas for years, and he basically is a smiling Nazi. And he would never approve of that. And it doesn't make sense to me that we have all these people who do social work in schools who are isolated from jails. People in jails get absolutely nothing by way of rehabilitation, and even less at TDC.
Well, if you take a young man, say, I mean, the man that they executed tonight, committed his crime when he was 19 years old.
Right.
And somewhere along the line, because of the absence of evidence or somewhere, they decided that he was a sense of future dangerousness to justify that. Somebody had to make that decision, didn't they?
Sure.
Okay. And he had been handled before.
He's a CPS kid. He was raised by CPS.
Yeah. And he had been handled before.
Sure he had been.
Now, what can you think of any reason in the world, with as many schools of social work and as many schools of psychology and departments of psychiatry we have in Houston, Texas, where we've got a dozen universities and medical schools and all of that, people that are locked up are certainly available to be studied for their patterns of behavior. And you can test people and make some kind of determination of their continued dangerousness. Why is there any effort at all or any movement that you know of at all to do some preventative maintenance here to keep from having to deal with progressively more dangerous people because of their going in and out of the system?
None. In fact, I had this dear friend, Richard Adair. In fact, he died in my kitchen just by being Adair. He just was a hellraiser. And he is in and out of jail. And he used to say, Skelton, how can I get reform watching? All I do is watch Night Train or Soul Train in the day room on TV. How does that reform me any? There's nothing, literally nothing. And it just seems crazy to me that we have all these different universities with people that are studying psychology. They should let these students that are graduate students come into jail and do group therapy and give them college credit for it.
Oh, see, you're talking about treatment.
Yes.
I'm talking about study to justify future plans of you. We're not doing that either.
It could go hand in hand. To my knowledge, there's never anything done until someone dies or gets killed in the jail. Then we'll have some ombudsman appointed, and for a while they get all excited about it. But nothing's ever been done. And it's just insane to have this many people locked up, sitting around doing nothing. And not only could you study their background as people, but you could also offer them some treatment during that period of time, at least defuse them. Because you take a kid like this, basics a CPS kid, and our agency's pretty well made him. He didn't have a choice. In fact, when I was reading his background, I kept thinking of that line that I read in a book about Sonny Liston that said he died the day he was born. Because he never, ever had a chance. And it seems like with this kid, with his background of being sexually abused, physically abused, beat up, mother's a drug addict, mother's an alcoholic, having this terribly, terrible bad background, that somebody in one of our agencies, we had 11 different foster homes that had him, twice he's taken away from his parents. But during that period of time, they obviously didn't do a hell of a lot to help him. And didn't do anything to at least help him with his problems. And he didn't help that. He didn't. When he was a little baby in the womb, they wouldn't give him a little IBM car. What kind of mama do you want? What kind of daddy do you want? He never had a chance.
No, you don't have to
ever
get to choose that stuff, no matter who you are.
Exactly.
Okay. Dave, are you back with us?
I'm back with you, Ray.
One other subject has come up. We've been talking here about Mr. Rise and his trial and his appeal, and that normally this case probably would not have been a capital case. It certainly wouldn't be today. And even at that time, 1999, had it occurred in Houston, it probably wouldn't have been filed as a capital case.
Mm-hmm.
But none of that has any meaning now because the witnesses have come out and crossed the room, and Mr. Rise is now a statistic in Texas of a growing number of statistics. It was the 12th person killed this year in Texas, and we didn't even start executing them until June.
Right.
And
we've
so,
got, I think, nine more scheduled. Right?
And we've nine more scheduled between now and Thanksgiving, and then we're going to stop executing people on the occasion of the world's most famous capital case.
Right.
But along the way, we also talked about that telephone situation. Do you have any comments about that?
Oh, well, I thought, you know, my first reaction to it was I could see on one hand how this would be very disturbing to get somebody to get a call that they weren't expecting like that. Of course, I get calls from people, and I'm sure you do too all the time, so it wouldn't have bothered me. But you know, the fact that it was on the front page of the Houston Chronicle, this was the big story, not that we were executing another person and that we had this many executions already this year, and we're probably going to, if the schedule goes forward, we'll have 21 this year, probably 50% of what happens in the United States. That's like not even an issue that warrants any coverage on the front page. But a cell phone call from death row does. And so I just look at it as, I mean, they put it there because it was something different. You know, they want to have some new angle. I understand all that, but the real story is that Texas is just executing people left and right like no other state in the union does, and that's just not news for the Houston Chronicle. We've had so many executions, I guess they don't even, you know, if it gets even in the second section on the third page, you know, that's something now. But a cell phone call.
Well, and the ancillary effects on it, there will be no visits on any unit in the Texas prison system this weekend at all for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
No visits in the trustee camps, no visits in the population on any unit, and so families are forbidden. The only direct contact inmates will have with their families this weekend is the prison show on KPFT and what cell phones they haven't found yet.
Right. I had a friend from Italy who came over one time, and I got a call. I took him up to the prison. I got a call from what I thought was him saying, "Pick me up." And I thought it was from him, and that he was at the exit coming out of the prison. And I got over there and asked, you know, where he was, and they got all upset. You know, did he carry a cell phone in? Well, the reality was that it was a phone call from somebody else from Italy at the Walmart up there in Livingston. So it was just a little bit of a mix-up, but they really freaked out to think that somebody had brought in a cell phone. And of course, that really doesn't happen with visitors. It happens with guards, and we all know that.
It's got to happen, guards. It's the only way to get... Visitors can't get telephones in. Guards can.
Yep, that's right.
That's the way that works. And I appreciate the work that you do, and I give our regards to the those have a regular at the vigil. And unfortunately, we'll be talking with you later in the week when we talk about Mr. Woods.
Right. Okay, Ray.
Thank you, Dave.
You take care. Bye-bye.
And so it's basically another one. By the way, Bobby Woods is scheduled to be executed on Thursday the 23rd, and I don't see anything on the horizon that would interfere with any executions at this point. Everybody's got a lot of rubber stamps at the courts of appeals, and the clemency boards are not paying too much attention to what their responsibilities are. We do this on the occasion of every execution. My name is Ray Hill, who I've been talking with here in the studio is Jim Skelton. Jim Skelton's knowledgeable. He's been a prosecutor. He's been a defense lawyer. He's a thoughtful human being wrestling with the same issues that you and I are. We are produced by Elizabeth Stein. Elizabeth is one of the volunteers who works with the prison show staff, and nothing would happen around here if it weren't for the wizardry of Otis McClay. Texas Execution Watch. How many times have we done this now, Elizabeth?
Oh, that's a good question.
We've done this almost a dozen times.
I think we've done it for almost every execution.
Every execution since we began, and we're going to continue to do it. I know we're a little hard to find. Those of you who find us on the internet, and those of you who find us on KPFT's HD2 channel. KPFT, yeah, it's down, so you're getting us on the internet, but you will get us on KPFT HD2 when that returns. KPFT is in fundraising mode, and we do this because the station gives us the freedom to do this. We are at liberty to bring you the kinds of radio that we think you may want to hear that you're not getting from any other source, or maybe whether you want to hear it or not, you need to hear it. Capital punishment issue is one of those things that we need to remind you that all of this executing is going on basically in your name, whether you support it or not. So we're here as a little irritating reminder of that. There's no visits in Texas prisons this weekend, so listening to the prison show may be interesting because you will hear a tone of desperation in families who would normally have visited this weekend, and their only chance of a few words of encouragement is on the prison show. What we do in radio is different from what everybody else does in radio. And that needs and deserves your support. We're brought to you by Pacifica Foundation, the owner of radio station KPFT Houston. And we will be back Thursday with another execution. In the meantime, we're going to let you ease out of here with some more Stevie Earle.
No, it's not Stevie Earle.
My name is Ray Hill, and we'll be back Thursday.
Whoa. If I get up in the morning feeling like I did today, hey, come on, where y'all? Outside. Hey, I'm gonna pack my suitcase, Captain.
Steve Earle didn't come, so we'll leave you with a Lomax collection of prison music sang by inmates in the fields, the cotton fields of southern prisons in the 30s.
Hey, I'm gonna get my fair baby off the river line. Hey, you tell me what you always thought on the red river run. Oh, Lordy, from the New York City to the Louisiana line, the Louisiana line. Boo, come on, with ya. Boo, with ya. Whoa, I'm going down to the levee for the summer gone, for the summer gone. Ah, get outside, will ya? Come up here. Hey! Whoa! I used to wait for Mr. Charlie. I used to wait for Mr. Black. I wouldn't leave Mr. Charlie to go nowhere.